You are listening to a sermon by Henry Neufeld, recorded on Sunday, October 18th, 2009, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, something rather unusual has happened, and that is two Sundays in a row, the speakers that are scheduled are not able to be here for the same reason. Jim Neuter was scheduled to speak today, and Paul Thiessen next Sunday. And maybe at the end of the morning, you'll wish that Jim might have been here. Thanks, Rosie, for those comments on Greenleaf and the concept of servant leadership. In preparing this, I came across his name, but didn't get around to doing any research on him, so that was very helpful. I want to begin by reading part of an article entitled, I Don't Want to Be a Servant, by John Alexander. Jesus and Paul were always telling us that we are to be servants, and to me that has always rung true. So I preached it a lot, and even tried to practice it occasionally. But that was before I knew what it was like to be a servant. Then this fall, I spent a month in Asia, mostly with people who had servants, and I didn't like what I saw. I don't want to be a servant. Servants are people who drive you to a restaurant and sit in the car while you eat. Servants are people who run in from the next room to get the salt for you because it's a foot out of your reach. They wash your dirty underwear by hand. Sometimes they sleep in the closet or on the floor. The Bible talks a lot about being a servant, but I'm rather sure I don't want to be that kind of a servant. The essence of being a servant is not existing. If you are a servant, you are to do all sorts of jobs without anyone having to notice that you exist. So when I came to a new place, I'd be introduced around, but a few people would be left out. I eventually realized these were the servants. They did not exist. One person told me of a discussion on evangelism in a wealthy church. The woman said that they knew so few people who weren't Christians that they didn't know whom they could evangelize. Finally, an outsider asked if most of their servants were Christians. And after a short silence, someone said, "I never thought of them." So I don't want to be a servant. I don't mind stuffing envelopes or even cleaning the toilet, though if I did it all the time, I'd probably change my tune. But I do want to exist. When I've stuffed 3,000 envelopes, I want someone to say thank you. I want someone to acknowledge my existence. So I'm not always pleased with Jesus. One time, for example, he asked whether any master thanks a servant for doing what was commanded. And he seems to think it was that not thanking them is perfectly okay. And that means Jesus not only told us to be servants, apparently he also knew what he was asking. Being a servant is not my idea of self-fulfillment. My next comments, in quite a different vein, come from a letter to former U.S. President George W. Bush, which was printed in the October issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. The writer, Andrew Sullivan, says he supported Bush in the 2000 election, but eventually lost faith in that administration during the Iraq War. He lost faith in Bush when the president signed a memo declaring that the Geneva Conventions about how war prisoners should be treated did not apply to captured terrorist suspects. The memo said that all prisoners would be treated humanely unless military necessity required otherwise. That loophole, military necessity, led to the resignation of Secretary of State Colin Powell. And it was the beginning of America's descent into that group of countries that systematically torture prisoners. This tolerance of torture, and the writer outlines the torture in some graphic detail, presents a larger problem when Bush publicly expresses his Christian faith. And the writer says, I am a wayward Catholic, and you are a born-again evangelical. Our faith tells us that what you authorized is an absolute evil. By absolute evil, I mean something that is never morally justified. I have no doubt that you believed you were doing your duty, but torture has no defense whatsoever in Christian morality. Our faith demands that the dignity of persons must be respected. Our faith teaches that each of us, even Sheikh Khalid Muhammad, is made in the image of God. Well, now to our texts. The Job passage is a surprising one. Job has been in a discussion with his three friends, and they're trying to figure out what Job has done to cause the disasters that have hit him. And they were serious disasters. His donkeys were stolen and his servants killed. Lightning hit the sheep and all were killed. A windstorm hit Job's house and all of his children were killed. Job had painful sores all over his body. He sat on an ash heap, scraping himself with a piece of broken pottery to cope with the itching. And they didn't have Mennonite disaster service, I guess. His three friends hear of his plight and decide to visit him. And they are shocked at what they see. They weep, they tear their clothes. And then they sit in silence with Job for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word because they saw how great his suffering was. That's remarkable behavior, to sit with a suffering friend in silence for 7 days. And finally Job starts talking with them, and most of the book is an exchange between Job and his friends. And the book has 42 chapters, and it's not till chapter 38 that God speaks about Job's plight. And the words we heard are part of our text. And God sounds pretty angry. Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Have you ever given orders to the morning? Do you know the laws of heaven? Do you send lightning bolts on their way? Does the eagle soar at your command? And this goes on for several chapters. And I find it surprising that God is this angry. And it's surprising because Job's friend has just finished his speech, in which he said, well, there's a lot more that has to be said on God's behalf. God is mighty. God is exalted in power. God is great. God does great things beyond our understanding. None of this seems to warrant a kind of angry response that God gives. It's full of, what the guy said, it's full of praise to God, much like the song that was read here this morning. So there's a lot of reverence expressed for God by Job's friend. Yet to these comments, God says, these are words without knowledge. That's quite a condemnation, essentially telling them, you don't know what you're talking about. I think it's a reminder that God is far greater than our minds can comprehend. And even Job's friend cannot adequately describe God. In the Mark passage, Jesus and his disciples are on their way to Jerusalem. Jesus has just told them he's going to be betrayed. He'll be sentenced to death. He'll be killed. 3 days later, he'll arise. And James and John come to Jesus and say, well, there's something we want you to do for us. And Jesus says, what is it? I'll see what I can do. And they said, arrange it so we get the highest places of glory in your kingdom, one on the right and one on the left. And Jesus says, you've got no idea what you're asking. You're going to drink the cup that I drink of, and you're going to be baptized with my baptism. As to awarding places of honor, that's not my business. Now, James and John were part of Jesus' inner circle. Jesus called them the sons of thunder. Presumably, this means that they were outspoken and bombastic and volatile, in-your-face kind of guys. Their attitude is not surprising. They've devoted 3 years to be with Jesus, and they've been away from their fishing business, and they want to get something out of this. They want their reward. It's not unlike our political party faithful in most countries who work for a specific candidate and who eventually hope for an appointment when their man gets selected. A cabinet post, an ambassadorship, a Senate seat, appointment to a commission, whatever. Patronage appointments, we call them. Well, when the other 10 disciples hear about this conversation, they lose their tempers with James and John. I would like to hear more about that discussion, but Scripture just says they just got mad at each other. So Jesus gets them together and talks about how godless rulers throw their weight around. And when people get a little power, it goes to their heads. It's not going to be that way with you, he says. Whoever wants to be great must become a servant. This is what the Son of Man has done. He came to serve, not to be served. So Jesus gives them an answer they don't like. It's not up to me who gets the choice appointments. Follow me and you're going to share my suffering. Follow me and you'll learn what suffering is all about. And Jesus gives them this lecture on servanthood as the way to greatness. His key point is that godless rulers will throw their weight around and little power goes to their heads. But it's not going to be that way with you. And his kingdom will be determined by the one who serves. So who is greater, the chairman of Microsoft or the waitress who serves him? In Jesus' way of thinking, it's probably the waitress. And this brings us to the whole problem of power and leadership. And there are different kinds of power. There is the power and authority that comes from one's position. The head of an organization, the leader of a denomination, the president, the prime minister, the police, the teacher, the CEO, all of these have a certain amount of power simply because of the position they hold. There is another kind of power, and that is the power that comes with expertise. A surgeon has a lot of power because of his knowledge in a specific field. Such expertise wields a lot of authority and power because of the knowledge in that area. Think of a lifelong farmer and what he all knows about crops, machinery, soil, and weather conditions. He has knowledge that gives him some power in the farming field. Jesus was quite concerned about power being used and abused. And that's where the letter to George Bush comes in. And despite what might have been good intentions to gather information about Al-Qaeda, the results were and are horrendous. Jesus says, don't be surprised when rulers do what George Bush did. But among you, it will be different. John Alexander's article reminds us that servanthood is not always fun and is not easy or pleasant. And in a similar vein, you might have read the article in the last Canadian Mennonite by Rachel Bergen about working as a waitress in Abbotsford. A few years ago, Sven Erickson wrote an article on church leadership. And he says there are people in the Mennonite church who demand and want strong, directive, authoritative, denominational leadership, essentially a CEO or a COO model. Other voices called for a patient, gentle, consensus-building type of leadership. The Evangelical Fellowship of Canada surveyed leaders in various churches and Christian organizations on the question, in your view, what is missing in Christian leadership? Servant leadership was most often mentioned lacking in Christian organizations. And that's somewhat surprising when Jesus said, among you, it's not going to be this way. Jesus' use of power was characterized by influencing others rather than controlling them. He focused on the needs of others, not on his own agenda. And the power he had is used for the benefit of others, not for self-glorification. In conclusion, we have Job being told in no uncertain terms that God is in charge, and that God's ways are not our ways, and we won't often understand them. And we are reminded in the Mark passage that Jesus stresses again the difference between his followers and the rulers of the world, those who make George Bush kind of decisions. We are reminded that Christians are here to serve, and serving is not always fun. Whoever wants to be great must be a servant. Servanthood is a choice that we make.